Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Bill, you remember the guy from that movie Borat?
I do.
Well, what if that politically incorrect character showed up at your family wedding? No, wait, what if a bad imitation of him showed up at the wedding?
I think the word you're looking for is awkward.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that later this hour. Meanwhile, what are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I am going to be flying home to Crescent City, a small town in Northern California.
Well, I'm going out this weekend, hopefully, some clubs, some restaurants.
Well, I am religious Jewish, so we don't go out on Saturday. We go to synagogue, eat with our family.
This weekend, I'm going to go Christmas shopping for my family and friends.
Having my 60th birthday party on Saturday night, actually.
It's going to be a beach-themed party with lots of friends because I'm from Florida. I would rather be on a beach than pretty much any place else anytime.
Beach-themed party in December. I hope that works. I hope it feels like Florida.
Me too. Those voices came from New York, Seattle, Anchorage, Alaska, and Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, this week, the campaign for president saw even more rhetoric on the ever-volatile issue of immigration. Republican Mike Huckabee was endorsed by the leader of the self-appointed Border Patrol group, the Minutemen. Mitt Romney started airing ads accusing Huckabee of being too soft on immigration, and state lawmakers have entered the fray. Last month in Oklahoma, a strict law went into effect making it a felony for anyone to transport, conceal, or house undocumented immigrants. Since then, weekends have become quieter in Oklahoma's Hispanic neighborhoods. Reporter Scott Gurian has our story.
The first thing you need to know about Capitol Hill is that it's not actually anywhere near Oklahoma's state capitol building. In the middle of Oklahoma City, which often seems defined by wide streets, chain stores, and strip malls, Capitol Hill is a compact little neighborhood with its own unique character. Like any other neighborhood, there are churches, banks, stores, and a movie theater, but most of the signs in their front windows are in Spanish.
Right now we're on the corner of Southwest 25th and Harvey.
And is this kind of in the heart of the Capitol Hill neighborhood?
That's the heart of Capitol Hill, yes, I'd say so.
Randy King is the publisher of El Nacional, a local Spanish-language newspaper. He points across the street to Tortilleria Lupita, a tortilla factory and convenience store, which supplies restaurants and meat markets throughout central Oklahoma.
It's a really popular place. They probably make the best tortillas in the city, maybe the state.
The walls inside are painted fluorescent lime green, and they're covered with framed sepia-toned photos of Pancho Villa and other Mexican revolutionaries. Owner Elias Bando says he's been saying goodbye to some of the regulars lately.
There's a couple of customers that used to come here often. They told us before they left, they said, you know, it's the last time coming here and buying from you. A lot of people moved to Kansas.
Why Kansas?
Because they had a family up there, and they said the laws are less stricter up there.
But they can't get tortillas like you make here?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
The story is similar at Max Pollo, a Mexican sports bar known for its seafood and grilled chicken. This place used to be extremely busy on the weekends, but owner Max Gaona says he's seen a lot of empty tables recently.
A lot of people is not coming back to the restaurant no more. The last 3 months, 4 months, sales went down for about 25-30%. They now believe the police are the immigration, so we know it's not that way, but I mean, not everybody knows.
Oklahoma's new immigration measure just took effect in November, but many members of the Hispanic community started leaving as soon as it became inevitable it would become law. Critics charge it's poorly written and its vague language has led to a lot of confusion and rumors about what it actually means. Gaona says that's caused his customers to have all sorts of fears and concerns, whether or not they might be justified. The climate of fear has also affected the neighborhood's discount grocery store down the street.
They did roadblocks just to check people out for their papers. They held one for about 2 hours right in front of my store. We were dead in here. Nothing. You know, it was just horrible.
Kay Garner has owned Budget Foods since 1985, and she's never seen anything like this. She says her customers have pretty much stopped shopping during the days and started coming in the evenings since they feel safer after dark. And there's more bad news, she says.
With the bounce checks that I've gotten hit with, I'm either selling or I'm closing the doors. It's hurt me that bad.
How soon do you think you'll have to make that decision?
I'm speaking to a man tomorrow about buying. I've talked to others and, you know, trying to find somebody. Otherwise, hopefully by the 22nd of December, I'll be closed.
Not everyone's hurting, though. El Nacional publisher Randy King says his newspaper's readership has actually gone up as readers are hungry for news about the state's immigration law. He says Hispanics here do think something needs to be done about the influx of undocumented immigrants. But as for this new approach...
I think it's misdirected, it's misguided, and it was so emotionally charged that I don't think people thought about the long-lasting effects of how this was going to affect the state.
But some state lawmakers say Oklahoma should go even further. One is working up a measure that would classify undocumented immigrants as human contraband. Anyone caught transporting or aiding them under that proposal could have their property seized, like in a drug bust. In Norman, Oklahoma, I'm Scott Gurian for Weekend America.
Scott tells us that despite the plans for even stricter immigration proposals in Oklahoma, there is some growing opposition from the business community to this latest measure, and there is an effort underway to get it repealed.
And in Arizona, employers and employees alike are waiting to see what's going to happen on Tuesday. That's the day a federal judge is supposed to decide whether a tough Arizona immigration law is going to go into effect on January 1st. Now, under the law, anyone who hires an illegal immigrant could lose his or her state business license. And that's ominous news since illegal immigrants make up an estimated 12% of Arizona's workforce. Well, no wonder there's been demonstrations over the immigration issue nearly every Saturday in Phoenix. They're out there on the city's east side even as we speak. Rene Gattel reports that the protests have taken on a life of their own.
Every Saturday for the last 8 weeks, pro- and anti-immigration protesters line the sidewalks along Thomas Road, a major Phoenix street, and yell at each other. On one corner are the migrant rights activists, holding signs in English and Spanish. One of the main organizers is 56-year-old Salvador Reza, who's wearing a bandana around his head, Karate Kid style.
Right here is an area of racial profile like you've never seen before. In fact, we're telling people not to come through this area if you're brown.
On the other corner are the counter-demonstrators, the Minutemen waving American flags, the retirees, and a whole lot of bikers dressed in leather. All this started when the massive furniture store across the street, Pruitt's, hired off-duty law enforcement officers to patrol the parking lot and keep day laborers from loitering looking for work. The store's owners say the migrants were harassing customers. As a result of those and other patrols, sheriff's deputies have arrested dozens of suspected illegal immigrants in this area in the last 2 months. Counter-protester Katie DeClusen says the store's doing the right thing.
Frankly, I'm tired of the illegal immigration. It's too much. They come over here and they try to push us around and, you know, Pruitt's is doing what they need to do to stand their ground and we're out here supporting them, helping them do what they need to take care of.
Across the street, in the parking lot of Pruitt's, there's a small fleet of black vans and patrol cars belonging to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Joe Arpaio is known for putting prisoners in chain gangs. He started an illegal immigration hotline for people to tip him off to undocumented migrants. A lot of the anger here is directed right at Arpaio.
He says the sheriff is going to go down.
If it's going to go down?
It's going to go down.
And then the answer is Arpaio what?
Same.
Arpaio's going to go down?
It's go down.
The only calm spot is inside the furniture store. Pruitt's is a Phoenix institution, the kind of place you go to buy oversized leather couches or cherry wood dining sets. But it's almost empty this Saturday. Owner Mike Sensing admits the demonstrations have hurt sales.
We don't want to be the epicenter of illegal immigration. We just want to sell furniture and let the government decide what needs to be done on the other issues. All we wanted was to not have our business affected by a day labor situation that the city should be able to do something with.
Sensing has joined the fray himself with his furniture vans. He's lined them on the edge of his parking lot and hung banners on them, condemning the mayor.
Good evening, on a gray house, you don't have to have.
Each Saturday, there's a feeling that anything could happen. There was the weekend back in November when the legal director of Arizona's ACLU was arrested for parking in front of Pruitt's. And then 2 weekends ago, while the protests were underway, sheriff's deputies rounded up 8 suspected illegal immigrants. Protesters like Linda Brown say they'll keep coming every week. Brown holds a sign that says, no KKK in Arizona.
We need more average Arizonans to see who these people are and to see, and they need to see that regular Arizonans are not going to tolerate their presence and their hatred.
The anti-immigration protesters think their side's gaining ground, too. 70-year-old Alan Becker has decorated his walker with American flags.
Well, we're going to come as long as they continue to protest the way they have. And, you know we have them on the defense now when you see them using things like KKK. They're at the last straw.
There have been dozens of immigration protests in Phoenix in the last few years. But what's happening on Saturdays outside Pruitt's is different. It's uglier and even angrier. Last weekend, as I'm standing there with my microphone, I notice a woman is yelling at me.
You are an agent of the enemy.
Ma'am, what's your name?
No comment.
She took my photo and said she was going to post it online somewhere, and then she stormed off. In Phoenix, I'm Renee Gattell for Weekend America.
Last week, Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon invited the owners of Pruitt's and immigration rights activists to sit down and talk. But both sides say they are not going to meet until some of their demands are met first. Go to our website where you can see pictures of the high emotions that are running. That's at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, baseball on drugs, sentencing for drugs, and the potent drug of American self-esteem. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. You're listening to Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. There was a lot of mind and body altering substance in the news this week, including the potent cocktail of American ignorance plus American self-esteem. And it's not necessarily bad news. The stuff this week might have struck you as good news or no news. And this is the kind of moral confusion we encourage on this program in this weekly segment. Joining me on this week's Good News, Bad News, No News panel, writer and comedian Dana Gould. His credits include The Simpsons. Hi, Dana.
Hello.
Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Bill.
And author, essayist David Rakoff. Hello, David.
Hello.
Our first topic. This week, the Supreme Court decided that federal district judges don't have to give longer sentences to crack cocaine offenders than to powdered cocaine offenders, even though the sentencing guidelines tell them to. So the next day, the U.S. Sentencing Commission voted to give thousands of crack convicts a chance for early release. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
I think this is great news. That distinction between crack and powdered cocaine turned out to be invidiously a racial difference, so that if you were poor and you got caught using crack, that was your most likely drug, then you would get a longer sentence than if you were rich caught using cocaine, because it was more likely you'd be using the powdered version. I just don't think that that's right.
Yes, it's good news. I agree with Amy. It was a patently racist policy.
It's good news, and the administration's complaint was that now it would clog the courts, which is, to me, a little better than the clogged prisons.
Yeah.
The argument used to be that crack is, it's more intense, it's cheaper, it's more addictive, it's more of a problem and needs tougher sentences.
It's a tricky argument to make in, you know, in the soundbite era, because, you know, you have to explain to people, just because I'm against unfair sentencing doesn't mean that I love crack and crack offenders.
Mm-hmm.
But to explain that, you need a comma. And that people don't have the time.
We did not have that.
So what you're saying is you hate freedom. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I thought.
He hates silence.
Uh-huh. I don't hate silence. I'm just terrified of it.
What about this topic? A new report ties more than 80 current and former Major League Baseball players to the use of illegal performance-enhancing substances. The report names names, including beloved heroes of the game, including the great pitcher Roger Clemens, the Rocket. Many sports writers are calling this the darkest day in baseball since the Black Sox scandal of 1919. But I'm asking you, good news, bad news, or no news?
Now that white millionaires are being accused, we have to review this sentencing disparity.
Uh-huh.
I am totally against this entire procedure. I've said this before on this show. I think that baseball players should be allowed to take any steroid or drug they can get their hand on. It's their body. They should be able to manipulate it. And I would like to see a day in my life where the average baseball player looks like the guy with the claw hands in the movie 300.
So this is this report is bad news?
I want to see large homunculi in chains and caps.
Okay. So what kind of news is this?
To me, it's bad news.
Bad news.
You know, Dana, I've heard your homunculus argument before, and it just doesn't wash with me. I think it's kind of awful that people have to make themselves ill in this way in order to exceed at their job.
They don't have to.
But what I think is bad news here is that the baseball institution has been so complicit in this. This report reveals that they secretly suspended testing in 2004 because they were afraid that they would have to reveal to a court the results of those tests.
So good news that this has come to light?
Yes.
I think it's no news.
No news?
It's no. We've always known this about baseball, and the fact that it's no news is actually bad news, because when, this is American heresy, I know, but when are we going to remove the false moral component that attaches to baseball? I mean, truly, if I have to tune into public radio and hear one more personal essay by some lachrymose, thick-throated straight guy waxing about Dodger Stadium, I'm going to vomit. I mean, these are just men. They're, you know, they're highly compensated, steroid-taking men. It's just, it is so boring to talk about the moral role model aspect of baseball as being this metaphor for America. It's not a metaphor for America. It's so boring to talk about baseball.
This is a weird coincidence that I'm only going to say because it's actually true. George Will is actually here with me because we play Dungeons and Dragons every Friday afternoon. I'm going to put him on right now.
He's lying. I paused.
George Will is my dungeon master.
Okay. Here's our next topic. An international exam shows that American 15-year-olds are behind students of most other industrialized nations in science and math, but the American students believe themselves to be ahead of their global peers. Is the combination of ignorance and confidence good news, bad news, or no news?
Do you know what happens when you get two stories, both of which are so incredibly old? What happens, they don't just become no news, they become anti-news.
Really? Other news gets sucked in around them?
The perennial thing about American kids not knowing as much of this as the Swedes is just as old as the hills. Also, isn't this endemic? Aren't they 15 years old? 15 means that you think you know everything and that everybody else is an idiot.
But is there not an argument, and I say this as a product of the American public school system, and I went to a very good public school. there was an implied American exceptionalism that was taught in public school that I think seeps into that, where you just assume that you're number one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if that leached into this sort of psychological positioning that these kids have.
And the good news argument is that that confidence has served this country pretty well.
Has it?
In a lot of ways.
I would say that the confidence actually, when people are informed of the fact that they have not learned something, that they don't crumble into a little pile of crumbs. They just go and learn it. And that takes a certain sort of a hard shell that I think can be productive.
But here's how this gets pernicious later in life. And I see this in, of all things, the war in Iraq. When the drumbeat to that started, the average person on the street had no conception. Why wouldn't they want to be like us?
So you'd rather America be in an old European-style malaise?
Bring on the malaise. A French world weariness.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what's the use?
That's what I want to hear.
Now do you feel better, Dan?
I want to see an eagle kick its nest out of the tree and turn to the camera and say, why?
That's a new America. This is a new day. This might be a Democrat slogan in the new election. It's dusk in America. That's a winning formula, Dana.
It's dusk in America.
Well done. That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford, comedian and writer Dana Gould. His credits include The Simpsons. And David Rakoff is the author of Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems.
Weekend America, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
When a journalist cartoons about Palestine, they're not what you'd call the funny pages. Coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Around this time last year, Charlie Schroeder could not stop imitating Borat. He thought he was being funny, posing as that fake journalist from Kazakhstan, but apparently nobody else did. His addiction peaked over Thanksgiving when he was at a friend's wedding in Mexico. He only knew a few people there, but he figured he'd charm the guests with his humor and dead-on impersonation. Charlie and the groom, Jay Rees, evidently are still speaking. Here they are with their story.
We arrived in Mexico in the middle of the afternoon, and it was the Puerto Vallarta airport. And Jay, who was hosting the wedding, was there. So I remember sort of greeting him. I think the very first thing that I said to him was, "Happy times! You know, it's your wedding. It's very nice." You know, foot hit the tarmac, and I was Borat.
Yekshimash! My name is Borat. This is my country of Kazakhstan.
I was possessed.
I don't remember the first time. I actually do, but I remember it, like, starting very early. I wish we knew, like, the opening date of the movie. It was probably, like, 3 weeks before, I would say. Like, it had already kind of caught on, and everybody was already doing Borat. So when Charlie was doing it, I was like, seriously, you're going to do Borat?
Well, I mean, the thing about The Wedding is that my wife and I knew Jay and Rebecca, the bride and groom, but we didn't really know that many other people. And when I'm in a situation like that, I go into entertainer guy mode. You know, I didn't even realize how much it was getting out of control because there was another guy there from New York. Like, the two of us would sort of encourage each other. I'd be like, hello, how you doing? And he'd be like, very nice. And then we'd be like, I'm good. And he'd be like, I'm good. You know, and it became sort of like we would feed off of one another.
I think what Charlie told me later is that he thought he was killing the whole weekend and that people were loving him. And we were all just like rolling our eyes, hoping it would go away.
I would say that in my waking hours, I was using the voice with strangers a good 50% of the time and not even aware of it. I mean, literally not aware that that's how often I was using it. Oh, my God. We had a Thanksgiving meal while we were there at the wedding. And, you know, they brought around the turkey. He's like, I like dark meat. And I was like, I like green beans. Very nice.
You know, anything was like, anybody want to go surfing?
Good to see you. It's nice to see you.
I do remember that. After the wedding, everyone was saying, like, congratulations, congratulations. And Charlie was like, high five. Hey.
I didn't have any idea that my Borat imitation was causing the kind of reaction that it was until about a month later when Jay and I were playing golf. He just kind of turned to me. He was like, Charles, why were you being such a tool at my wedding?
Somehow the Borat thing came up, and I told Charlie that, you know, he was a bit of a tool.
And I didn't know what to think. All this time, I thought that I was Mr. Entertainer, you know? When Jay said to me, you know, why was I being such a tool doing Borat? I mean, I immediately stopped doing it. Every time I started doing it, I bit my lip and really just... In fact, since then, I haven't really done any impersonations at all. Borat, he will not be coming out at all. Maybe a little. Just once. But that's it. Just to get a laugh.
Don't do it! Charlie Schroeder and Jay Reese live in Los Angeles.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
American Public Media welcomes you to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Comic books have long abandoned the need to be funny. Take a trip to your local comic book store and you're going to find comics about everything from family problems to the Holocaust. Joe Sacco is a comics journalist. He draws about war. He's written about Bosnia and Iraq. His 1993 series of comics about Palestine were later collected in a book, and this week, the special edition of Palestine goes into wide release. It includes excerpts of the journals that he kept while traveling there. Welcome to Week in America, Joe.
Happy to be here.
How has your work evolved since Palestine?
For the better.
Yeah?
Well, I don't know. I hope so. As much as I like the first book, Palestine, as much as I feel like that's kind of that has a power that I don't know if any of my other books have had since. I'm more conscious of what I'm doing. I'm more aware of how to go about things. It's become more journalistically, I don't want to say the word precise, but it's, I have a better understanding on how to get a story, and that just comes with experience. With the drawings, I've probably toned them down somewhat. I let the drawings work with the writing and with the story more than I used to. Even if it means drawings that when I'm doing them are kind of boring to draw, but they work for the story.
When you draw yourself, you wear glasses, and the glasses are opaque. They're white. And I'm thinking, well, here's the guy I'm supposed to be seeing everything through, his eyes, and yet I can't see his eyes. Tell me about that choice.
You know, it's funny because, I mean, it sounds a little silly, but it's that whole notion of the eyes are the window to the soul. And I guess I want people to see part of my personality. I want them to get a feeling for my personality, but I know the reader isn't really going to get to know me personally. And there's a certain emotion you feel in those situations when you're hearing these terrible stories and you're seeing terrible things, and you want to sort of hide that on some level, because if you demonstrate it, I think it gets in the way. You know, it's not that important that I was emotional during certain scenes. What's important is that the reader gets the impact of the story. And so maybe that's what the opaque glasses are about.
In the reflections that you add in the preface of your book, Palestine, you end that reflection with saying that your idea was not to present an objective book, but an honest one. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think with journalists, too much attention is paid to this notion of presenting a so-called objective picture, which generally often can mean you talk to some people, and then you go to the spokesperson on the other side and get a quote to sort of, you know, balance it out. But I find sometimes this balancing it out, what that involves is washing it out, so that what the journalist actually knows is going on, or what they really feel is an important point, is being sort of lost. And a journalist often thinks he or she is done when they've presented both sides of the story. What I want from a journalist is what they would tell me if they were sitting across from me at dinner. Like, what is going on over there? You tell me. That's what I want. But I want an honest appraisal of what's going on. And that's what I meant by that.
Well, what do you say to those critics who say that what you have created isn't objective or isn't balanced, you know, that it is very much slanted to one side?
I say they're right. I say it isn't objective. I say it isn't balanced. What I am doing, when you say slanted to one side, I think of it as presenting one side that isn't well told and telling it honestly. In other words, if you're talking about the Palestinians, if you hear things that you feel like isn't good for their cause, you're still going to report that, because that's just part of the story. You're being honest about the warts, you know, but you are trying to present their story from their point of view.
Well, now you're writing a book about the Gaza Strip, and you actually took your other book, Palestine, with you when you were researching that. What kind of reaction did you get from people when you showed it to them?
It's funny, because when I was first doing journalism comics, I was a little hesitant to tell people I was doing this in comic book form as a cartoonist. Now I find it really helps with people, especially if they're not English speakers, English language proficient, you know. Mm-hmm. Because what I found is I would sit in someone's home in Gaza, let's say an old man in his 70s, and I would hand him the book Palestine, and he would get it right away. He would open it up, and he'd see pictures of the refugee camp, pictures of, you know, his life or something he understood, and he'd get right away what I was trying to do. And I've thought, well, if I'd written a book in prose and handed that to him, he might have, you know, nodded his head like, you know, thank you for the effort, but he wouldn't have got it. He wouldn't have known really what I had written.
Joe, I want to thank you for joining us at Weekend America.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
This weekend, Joe Sacco is working on his book about the Gaza Strip. He's been working on it off and on for the last 5 years, and he tells me he'll be lucky if he even finishes it next year. In the meantime, you can check out excerpts from Joe's book, Palestine. It's all at our website, weekendamerica.org.
This weekend, a lot of parents are out there supporting their kids at their holiday performances, from grade school to high school. But sometimes that urge to perform during the wintertime does not end with school. Listener Rebecca Summerlott lives in Orlando, listens to us on WMFE. She's an English teacher at University High School. This is her fourth year singing with her students and other faculty members at the Candlelight Processional at Disney's Epcot Center. Rebecca says starting the holidays this way helps dissolve the lines between teacher and student.
The kids are always surprised when they learn that I'm going to be singing with them because it gives them insights into me that they didn't have before. It's kind of like when you run into a teacher at the grocery store. Knowing that your teacher has facets that go beyond just the classroom can be shocking for a lot of kids because they think that all I do is teach. So when they find out that I enjoy singing and that I've been singing for my whole life, basically they're kind of impressed, I think. Not so much because I'm like good or anything, but because it's nice for them to see that, you know, I do have a life outside the classroom. That there's more to me than just a lady who assigns essays and projects and all kinds of things that they don't really like to do. My favorite part in the performance, and it never fails to bring tears to my eyes, is when we sing Silent Night. And the arrangement is we sing the first verse in German, and then we get to the middle of the song, and then the conductor turns around, and the lights go on the audience, and it's a cue to the audience to sing the chorus of Silent Night with us in English. And we all sing together. And I look out into the crowd, and I can see all these different people who have come from all over the place, and they're all singing. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild. And then we finish that, and the conductor turns back around, and I have to real quick, like a bunny, blink the tears out of my eyes. Then we sing again. I think it's probably the favorite song of the audience because it gets them involved. They're no longer just sitting and listening. They get to be part of the fun. Singing at the Candlelight Processional at Epcot really helps me get into the Christmas spirit because I live in Orlando where it's often 80 degrees on Christmas Day, and we don't have the chill in the air, the snow that people up north have that helps them start getting ready for the holidays. And so singing for me helps me feel, okay, Christmas is coming and it's going to be a good time.
If you're in Orlando this week, Rebecca will be performing with the University High School Choral Group this Wednesday and Thursday at the Epcot Center Candle Processional. That's at Disney World.
There is something special about singing in a group of people.
Yeah, there really is. And the word carol comes from an old French word that means circle dance. So the whole idea is about participation. I'm wondering if that's why people get bitten by the performance bug when they hear Christmas carols. You know, when you think about it, except on that camp bus or during Mamma Mia, when are you ever encouraged to sing along?
Well, what about you? What is the story about your most excellent holiday performance? Whether you were on the stage or in the seats, we would really love to hear it.
Share that moment with us. Go to weekendamerica.org.
It is a snow-filled winter in much of the Midwest. That's not going to stop all the outdoor adventures. Here's John Moe's look at weekend weather.
Folks in Chimney Rock, North Carolina are big fans of Scratch and Sniff, but see no reason why it needs to be reserved for books. So they're taking it to the woods for a guided Scratch and Sniff hike, identifying various species by smell under showers in 43. Remember, easy to smell the skunk, no need to scratch it. Nothing's better on a rainy, windy, 34-degree Boston day than a lovely cup of tea. Unfortunately, they're dumping the tea in the harbor again. The reenactment of tossing 342 crates of tea, a.k.a. the Boston Tea Party, gives warning to the British not to tread on us in case they wanted to come back and tread on us. If you have a sore throat, feel free to dump 342 crates of honey in there as well. When is it okay to wear only a Speedo in public? That's right, never ever. Oh, one exception. Santa Monica, California's Speedo Run. Joggers, clad in immodest trunks, sprint around raising money for charity and wishing it was a bit warmer than 63. After running around town in Speedos, they gather at a local bar. That's right, they go to the bar after running around in Speedos. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Have time to say the rosary, maybe you can just hum along. Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This Sunday is the third Sunday of Advent. The season of Advent is like the new year for the Christian church. Bill Guildenstern is celebrating Advent at his Michigan church this weekend. He's a devout Catholic. He'll be saying the rosary, as he does nearly every day. Bill and his partner, John Geyer, they have a business together. They work in Saginaw, Michigan, and they've been collaborating on the rosary tapes, putting the rosary to music. They just completed their fourth CD in the series, Mysteries of Light. Each CD puts rosary prayers like the Hail Mary and Our Father to music. Well, people have been praying the rosary for centuries, so why mess up a good thing? Maybe we should just let them explain. Here's Bill.
I guess our story goes back to the summer of 1992, and I was driving down to John's house one day, and I happened to be praying the rosary using the rosary beads, and they got stuck in the track of the seat, and I couldn't get them out. So I kind of thought to myself, you know, there's got to be a better way. And then it came to me, why not do the rosary on tape? So I basically built the melody for Silent Night on a keyboard, called my wife in, she sang the song, and the two of us read the meditations and prayed the prayers. And so what we did is we took about maybe a 5.5 minute song down to John's house the next day.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Well, Hail Mary. I actually thought Bill was out of his mind. He said, well, why don't you call Debbie, my wife, into the kitchen and let her listen to this. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing and hearing. She started listening and started to cry. And I'm the first to admit that I wanted nothing to do with it in the beginning, but that's completely out the window now.
We're not competing with the church organist. It's been our intention all along to compete with the other songs on your iPod. We're not creating a prayer for in church. We're creating a CD for when you're out in the world, driving down the street or sitting in the den or whatever.
The music is mainstream, and some of the songs could be played on pop radio. Commercials all over America. I mean,
geographically, everything from the Portland Pirates hockey team in Portland, Maine, to Linder's Furniture in Los Angeles.
You know, when it comes down to a technology, you kind of adapt things you know. And the same technology was used for the Rosary tapes, just getting people to remember the psychological hooks in prayer.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
I really never prayed the rosary until the tapes were created. I'm a Catholic, and I go to church every once in a while. I have to remind myself that I do pray the rosary now just by listening.
I think praying is a lot like exercising. You know, we kind of do it for ourselves. Even when we're praying for other people, we're getting benefit out of the time that we spend in prayer and meditation.
We've had people all over the world contact us.
Indonesia, the Philippines, Africa.
People exercising to it. Pope John Paul, before he died, contacted us and blessed us and thanked us for doing it. After that, we got contacted by the Papal Nuncio and the Vatican.
Responses that we've gotten are, "We Are Your Rainbow," seems to be the favorite of a whole lot of people. It's about the fact that we're all different from each other in the way we look and the way we feel and the way we walk and the way we talk and every other way. And it's that difference that together makes us as beautiful as a people as we are.
This weekend, Bill and John are going to be working on a video for We Are Your Rainbow. Look for it to premiere on GodTube in the next couple of weeks.
GodTube. Des, you talked to Bill and John. So besides substituting for the rosary you lost under your car seat, how do they envision people using their music?
Well, they said, like, whenever it's not comfortable or convenient to pray the rosary using the beads, like on the treadmill, doing yard work. And I should note that those musical interludes that we heard are interpretations of the mysteries of the rosary. They're not the actual prayers.
And how does their rosary music jibe with the ad and jingle business?
Yeah, well, at first, John did not want any of his business associates to even know he was behind the rosary tapes. He didn't want to be known in business circles as the rosary guys.
Right. And what changed his mind?
Well, Bill got sick and nearly died while they were in the middle of this project. And John has always been moved by Bill's faith, but certainly after he recovered, John was also transformed. So Bill is doing great now, and John is more in touch with his own faith. And if you'd like to hear more music from the Rosary Tapes, just go to our website. It's at weekendamerica.org.
That's it for another hour of Weekend America, produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Sean Cole, who's not at his sister's birthday party on Cape Cod this weekend due to the impending nor'easter, Neil Ill, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Tim Bamba, and Susie Lechtenberg. Susie, enjoy the honeymoon this weekend.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, Phyllis Owens, and Angela Kim, who's in New York celebrating a friend's birthday, John Moe, Mark Sanchez, who'll be taking his winterized bike out for a test ride.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
This is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for courage.
Yeah, when you come in here, you see a whole bunch of people in there. Hey, they go Poogie. They go Mikey. You know, I didn't expect to see him here. They make you kind of feel like, okay, well, if they're going to do it, then I can do it.
Conquering errands, braving to-do lists, listening to the most memorable stories and ideas every Saturday. Weekend America. Join us.